There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast with me, Richard Dean. This is our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Wednesday, October the 23rd. Like rain. Nearly 2 years since we introduced VAT and excise duties here in the UAE, and we've got a special report on what it means for you and your money. First of all, your thoughts on indirect tax in the UAE. Ali, for example, has been in touch, and he says, and Malk, he agrees with you on this, that taxes are inevitable.
We have a great country here, fantastic community, so I don't mind at all to have more tax, more VAT, because it all will be reflected in the services, the quality. Been here for many years with this free tax in the before. I don't mind to have a future with more tax or fees, because at the end of the day, it is really added to the quality here more and more.
Yeah, I'm a bit Singlish on this. I like the greenery, I like the roundabouts, and I like all the sort of...
Libraries.
Libraries, all these sort of things. I'm not sure I go quite as far as Ali and say I don't mind paying as much as you want to charge me, but I can accept what we're paying at the moment in the way of indirect taxes. Would I pay 5 or 10% in the way of income tax off the top of my salary? Yeah, possibly. Well, yeah, maybe not. Yes, no, I'm not. I've no idea. But we do pay a lot of indirect taxes here, and they're things that don't come off your salary. There are things that kind of more or less reflect your spending, things like the VAT that we spend on everything, 5%, SALIC, parking fees, labour costs, visa, licensing, company registrations, fines, speeding and parking, etc. 5% municipality housing fee, the excise tax on fizzy drinks and fags and things. And hotels, be that 10% plus 7% plus 20 dirham charge on when you stay a night in a hotel. I don't know if I've missed anything. I probably have, but those are the sort of things. And KPMG have just had their indirect tax conference yesterday here in Dubai. And we'll hear from Lachlan Wolfers in just a moment. But Stuart says that VAT, for instance, even at 5%, has changed how he spends.
Well, since the inception of VAT, I think it's actually significantly helped me with my savings. I proactively try to spend less now, which means I'm able to send more money out of the UAE on a monthly basis.
That is Stuart, and Lachlan Wolfers, who is the Global Head of Indirect Tax at KPMG. We asked him, first of all, what do you make of the tax system that we do have here in the UAE?
I've gone through the implementation of new VAT systems in three different countries now. I did it in Australia, did it in China, and then I've also been involved in Malaysia as well. And it follows a familiar pattern. You introduce new rules. It tends to have a bit of teething problems along the way. They typically start at a low rate, like we've done here. Provided the system is kept simple, after a couple of years, it tends to bed down and people get familiar with it, more used to it. And then often what happens, you've seen this elsewhere, rates tend to increase following that.
We also asked him, what's the most typical situation when it comes to changes in the rates of VAT? You, Malcolm, have a theory on this, don't you?
Well, I think it never goes down, does it? It's going to go creep up and up and up. And let's face it, a lot more places around the world pay more than we do. And Lachlan sort of said yes, effectively.
You know, you talk about 5% here. The average rate of VAT around the world right now is close to 20% amongst OECD countries. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second we're going to go from 5% to 20%. What you'll see is that, that sort of 2.5% leap that you're referring to is not unusual. I think New Zealand followed that pathway. Australia, where I'm from, there's a lot of pressure on the government to try and increase their rate. You will expect some sort of increase in the future.
Because we were all resistance when VAT was announced. I was at a gold conference that said that 60% of the companies in Dubai would depart and head off to Turkey to set up business there in the gold market. That didn't happen, did it? And of course, we've all got used to it. We've set up the systems to do the accounting. We've employed people. Richard, your business has likewise had to make adjustments.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small consultancy business, but yeah, you've got expenses in terms of the software is pretty cheap, but you've got to hire more accountants to.
You've got more accountants to do all the business and everything
every quarter,
else.
You get a quite significant bill for VAT.
But they've broken your resistance because you're paying it now. How simple would it be to change that 5% input into your system to 7.5% or 10%. It's going to happen someday.
It would take this. 5, delete, 7, enter.
And that's it. That's how easy it would be for the government to get 2.5% more on the money that we spent. And why not?
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking tax, special report on the impact of tax so far and the future direction. Joining us in the studio to tell us how it's impacting the restaurant industry is Naeem Madad, the chief executive and founder of Gates Hospitality, which owns a string of restaurants across Dubai, including the likes of Reform and Folly. So nearly 2 years in, what's been the impact of VAT and other indirect taxes like excise on your businesses?
Yeah, well, I believe VAT has really put a huge impact on cash flow in particular, because again, these bills are due and they're due and they need to be paid very quickly and efficiently. So cash flow has been the biggest impact. Not to forget the cost of living generally across the board. Let's not kid ourselves. We pass this on to the consumers.
Okay, so if I walk into one of your restaurants today and pay 100 dirhams, let's say it's a 100 dirham bill, how much of that, out of the various taxes that Malcolm has been listing diligently today, how much of that is going to the government in one way, shape or form?
So you have 7% municipality fees.
Okay.
Followed by the VAT of 5%.
Okay, so we're up to 12 dirhams of my 100 is already gone to the government.
Correct. Right. And then thereafter, as a consumer, you have your service charge tax as well, which appears on the bill.
What if I buy, a Sprite or a Coke or a Pepsi or a Red Bull or something, and the excise duties on those?
Well, excise duties are applicable, they're enforced, and again, they double-digit percentages. So again, reflects that, all reflected in the pricing from a consumer's perspective.
How much of an impact has it had on your restaurant and the restaurant industry in particular? One extreme we could have, it's just been a drop in the ocean and you've taken it in your stride. At the other extreme we'd have, it's had a massive impact and is really difficult. Where on that spectrum would we be?
Look, I think the first 6 months had a massive negative impact. I think people are concerned, confused. I'm not used to the actual fact of having to pay VAT. 6 months into it, 2 years into it today, I think people have gotten accustomed. But what we have witnessed is that people have started to watch their spending patterns. People have had a reaction on, should I be spending? Should I have that second drink? Should I have that second main course and an entree? So the spending patterns have been impacted on that, definitely.
What's the cost of VAT to a restaurant as a business, though? I mean, if we look at it simplistically, you know, I'm paying VAT, you, the restaurant, are paying VAT maybe on the steak that you're buying, but then I'm paying VAT when I eat that steak and buy it off you. So I'm paying the money rather than you. What's the cost for you in this equation?
Look, our approach has been, let's have a look at our menu cost compilations and our beverage compilation cost as well. And certain dishes can actually absorb the 5%. Some other dishes weren't, they were already overpriced. So we had to come up with a magical formula where that 5% is somehow massaged to a certain extent, so the guests as consumers don't have that full impact. But again, as a business, the VAT is not absorbed fully by ourselves. We pass it on to consumers.
And what about the extra you're paying in terms of accountancy fees, software fees and the rest of it in order to calculate the VAT?
Again, it's single-digit percentages. I wouldn't worry about those. We have those finance people in-house already. We do all of these kind of works for our own records. So it's an extra chapter, which is not a big cost. Cash flow is the biggest issue, like I started by saying.
Let's look more broadly at how the restaurant industry is faring at the moment as we head towards what is sometimes a busy time of year, the end of year. People often go out a little bit more. You've said many times before on this show that it's a challenging restaurant environment. I'm looking on TripAdvisor and it's got reviews of 11,822 restaurants in Dubai at the moment. Are we seeing many restaurants closing in Dubai yet with the competitive pressures that, you've spoken about before?
I'll start with the positives. We're seeing a lot of openings, but equally as many closures are taking place. So it's one for one. And again, early in the year, municipality put out a report of new licenses. We're looking at 2.5 licenses per day, new licenses coming onto the market. Definitely, we don't talk about the closures, but they are matching the openings. So we're still hovering just under the 12,000 mark of restaurants operating in the market today. Market continues on being challenging. Nonetheless, it is a season, and we have seen a spike in revenues over the last 3 weeks. We believe that a lot of the holiday makers are back. Schools are back. The first fees for school have been paid. So I think we're seeing a lot of people spending a bit more money now back into the hospitality and leisure industry.
Are there any upsides for you of what's happening globally and economically? Are you, for example, benefiting from what has been a weaker pound? Buying in your salmon, whatever it happens to be?
Currencies, trade wars don't have any benefit on our industry. As a matter of fact, they are a strain because the sentiments are all negative. So people automatically are stopping the spending. They're thinking twice about their spending patterns. We have witnessed a slowdown rather than a positive impact on those. My biggest fear about this whole taxation is that we should be very careful on moving forward, because we all know what happens once such taxes are implemented and are in place, isn't there going back? And the only way usually is onwards and upwards. So we need to make sure that Dubai doesn't price itself out of the market and becomes a one-off destination. This morning I was reading the newspaper, and our colleagues in Lonely Planet have added Dubai to the 10 cities of must-do in 2020, which I believe is phenomenal and very exciting. But we need to make sure that they do come back after 2020. So it's not a one-off city. Let's make sure that it's affordable, it represents value, and it caters for all levels of the spectrum.
Naeem, great talking to you as ever. Appreciate your time. Naeem Madad, Chief Executive and Founder of Gates Hospitality, owner of a string of restaurants across Dubai. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
And let's start with Adam Neumann, who's the founder of WeWork. He was, until a few weeks ago, the chief executive. He was, until recently, the chairman, but no more, because
now he's an observer. Officially an observer.
He's not even got a seat on the board, has he not, Brandy?
No, he's leaving the board. He retains observer status. And $1.7 billion before you start worrying too much about his career prospects.
This is him. We'll get the details in a second. But this is Adam Neumann in happier times talking about his plans for WeWork, the co-working office company.
I think the next 100 years, everyone sitting here, you're the leaders of the future. City states is where it's at. I think governments from all over the world, without pointing any fingers, are having a very difficult time.
Adam Neumann. $1.7 billion. That's chunk of change.
It is. Look, I mean, this has not gotten the way that anybody expected. When that prospectus went out a couple of months ago ahead of the share sale for WeWork, hoping that the company would raise as much as $65 billion, and then that prospectus effectively, and Adam Neumann's relationship with the company and his relatives and all the rest of it, being basically pulled to pieces, which has cut the evaluation right down. How much does the SoftBank investment, it's putting $5 billion in, I mean, what's the, you had the actual valuation of that, didn't you, Malx, at one stage, of how much it's worth now?
It's about $8 billion, which is below the sort of the IPO price. That slipped and slipped and slipped from about 40 down to about 12, and then it's eight is lower than any expectations. And although, you know, it's quite a chunk of change, it's still nowhere near the size of chunk of change that he would have been expecting.
No, well, exactly. I mean, at one stage, when the company was worth $65 billion, his stake would have been worth $14 billion. Nothing has gone to plan, including for SoftBank, by the way, who obviously weren't expecting to have to step in and bail out one of their investments.
They estimated it was going to be about $49 billion was their valuation.
So here's what, according to the Wall Street Journal, Neumann is getting for his $1.7 billion as part of. $1 billion for the sale of his shares. And remember, he already had to give up a load of voting power, because initially he had 20 times the voting power of other shareholders, and then that got cut down last month to just 3 times that of ordinary shares. He's also going to be getting a $185 million consultancy fee, reportedly, and a $500 million line of credit. They are, incidentally, at the same time, according to The Guardian this morning, weighing up sacking 2,000 people.
And they couldn't do it before this bailout because they couldn't afford the severance package, couldn't they? They couldn't afford to fire them, but now they can.
And those redundancies are still continued to be on hold while that refinancing is going through, but they are, The Guardian says, expected soon.
I've been looking at aviation and redundancies. We'll talk about Boeing in just a second, but first of all, Air New Zealand says it's going to launch a non-stop flight service between Auckland and New York a year this month, October 2020, to take advantage of the strong visitor growth that it sees from North America. And at the same time, it's going to stop the lower performing Los Angeles to London route on the same date. What is that that's going to do? That's going to close down the Air New Zealand London cabin crew base. So they are going to have no crew based in London anymore. There'll be about 130 people at the moment who won't be based there, about 25 roles in its sales office in Hammersmith, and ground team will also disappear. They're basically focusing on more Pacific Rim routes. Now, 737 MAX causing Boeing all sorts of problems, and they had a big meeting in San Antonio, Texas, to try and figure out what to do. And on American news channels last night, we heard this.
Tonight, a shakeup in the top ranks at Boeing. Kevin McAllister, the man in charge of returning the troubled 737 MAX to service, is out.
It's gone. Yeah, he was president, chief executive of Boeing Commercial Airlines, BCA, and he's been the fall guy, really. A lot of people saying that he came very much at the end of the 737 MAX development program, and he's just taken the hit for this. One person familiar with the matter said McAllister's departure has been described to staff as a separation, which is a clear indication that he had indeed been fired. Taking over, Stan Deal. He is going to take over as that president and chief executive of BCA.
Lots of newsmakers losing their jobs. Bit of a merry-go-round in corporate America overnight. As you mentioned, Mr. McAllister gone. Adam Neumann at WeWork gone. Also gone, Mark Parker at Nike. He's been the CEO for more than a decade. And to be fair, he's done a really, really good job. The share price has increased ninefold over that period. But he is leaving under a bit of a cloud because it's just a couple of weeks after the company Nike had to shut down the so-called Oregon Project. And that was after head coach Alberto Salazar was banned for 4 years after being found guilty of doping violations. But he says, Mark Parker says, that's not the reason he's going. He says the reason he's going is that they brought in a new guy who was formerly the head of eBay. He said because Nike is going digital and we need a digital guy in charge, which seems odd to me for what is essentially a footwear and apparel company or sneaker
company. Sales, digital sales.
And that's what he says. He said, we are having to completely digitize the company, digitize Nike. And this, Mark Parker said, is why they've got the new guy on board.
Digital has been, we have used that word a lot, digital transformation, with areas like digital product creation, consumer demand sensing, flexible manufacturing, and responsive manufacturing as well. John comes in, adds horsepower, and I think he's going to help us accelerate our whole digital transformation.
Mark Parker at Nike stepping down as CEO, but he is sticking around as, I think, executive chairman.
And another to go is the CEO, Kevin Plank.
Should we play Queen?
From Under Armour.
Another one bites the dust.
Well, this, do you know what? This interests me particularly, A, because I've met Kevin Plank a couple of times. I've interviewed him twice here in Dubai, once when they were setting up the big Under Armour store in Dubai Mall, and then about a year later I spoke to him in March of this year when they were back. Kevin Plank isn't just the CEO of Under Armour. He's the guy who started it in his grandma's basement. So he is the founder as well, which makes it, I think, a bit more of an emotional deal to step aside. We don't quite know why he's stepping aside. It's been an interesting couple of years for Under Armour and Kevin Plank. Just small stuff to do with company culture, with a bit of a sort of a disagreement, if you like, with US President Donald Trump. He was one of the first CEOs to jump out of the Manufacturing Council in 2017. He's another one who won't be completely leaving the company. He's going to become the executive chairman and the brand chief at Under Armour. But here's what I was thinking this morning, because having spoken to Kevin a couple of times, he's extremely passionate about the company that he himself started. How do you go from being the CEO, the big decision maker on a daily basis, to I mean, yes, you have a lot of power checks and balances, if you like, if you are the executive chairman, and we don't quite know what the brand chief role is going to involve. But how do you watch someone else doing your main gig every day?
I tell you what you do. You go and buy the Steve Jobs biography and figure out that happened to Steve. He was fired from Apple. And then you plot your comeback. Maybe that's what you do.
I mean, we're not saying Kevin Plank has been fired, by the way, before the lawyers start circling. Like I said, there's, I think, more questions than answers for this one. Under Armour as well, struggling a little bit in the US market. The growth there, not what they would like to see.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get some more insight now on one of the big regional stories that is still developing, the ongoing situation in Lebanon. Delighted to be joined in the Dubai Eye studio by Dr. Nasser Saidi, president of Nasser Saidi & Associates and a former economy minister in Lebanon. Dr. Saidi, thank you for joining us. So we'll get your thoughts on the latest developments in Lebanon in a second. But first of all, let's take a step back. Clearly, you've been following this closely. What was the catalyst for the unrest that we've seen on the streets of Lebanon over the past few days?
You've got three, I think, sources of the crisis. One is a deep economic, financial, fiscal, and monetary crisis. The other one is an environmental crisis. We saw fires, there's pollution. And the first and foremost, I think, is the issue of corruption and the lack of trust of government in handling any of the three crises. And that has erupted right in the street. It is across Lebanon. It is cross-sectarian, across age groups. So it's a very wide and deep popular revolt.
The immediate catalyst was attacks on, of all things, WhatsApp, the That's messaging true. Service, wasn't it? Why could something as seemingly innocuous as that light the touch paper for what we've seen over the past week?
Because it reflected the fact that government was thinking of reducing the deficit, which it needs to, but then thought of measures which directly impact really across classes and really the poorer and middle segments of the population. People in Lebanon rely on WhatsApp for voice over IP, right? And they use that to contact their relatives, friends all over. And when you hit them with that, although it does not look like a large amount, $6 per month, but for many people who are on salaries of $250 or $300 per month, that's a lot of money. And that really triggered this revolt.
We've had the response from the government led by Saad Hariri. A number of economic reforms have been proposed. You've got symbolic gestures such as politicians taking a 50% pay cut to more substantive proposals such as privatizing telecommunications and fixing the electricity company, which is a big problem there. What do you make of the reforms that were put forward?
There's an 18-point plan. The major point is to reduce the budget deficit to 0.6%. Now, to put that in perspective, the deficit for this year is 9.5% of GDP. So is it at all realistic to go from 9.5% to 0.6? And the answer is no. So there is really not much credibility. And if you look at the other measures, they all require structural reforms, laws to be passed through parliament. And the history of Lebanon is that you can pass laws through parliament, but once they go through parliament, what you put in is not what you get out. You put in meat, you get out sausages. And then the next point is that they are not implemented. And that is the major issue. There is no longer any credibility and confidence in the governance of the state.
I mean, it's a long way from looking like Hong Kong. I'm looking at the pictures now at the moment, and it's all seems very good-natured. Strong protest, but good-natured. And as you said, all ages, sexes, Muslims and Christians here together, I can see. And it all looks like they're marching for something, and now that that's given, that maybe they'll go home. What do you think? Is this kind of going to keep them happy?
No. If you look at the reaction on the street, as they say, and on the social media, 85% of comments on social media were negative to the 8-point plan. Again, this is the issue of credibility, and I don't think people will go away so soon. What you need is a change in government and in governance. And people will not be satisfied simply with some promises. on reforms that have been discussed for the past 10 years and nothing got implemented.
I guess for Sartoriri, given the way that his father was killed, that post means an awful lot to him. He's not going to give it up lightly.
He will not give it up. But what's more than that, he will not be allowed to give it up. None of the other parties and allies want to see him go, actually, because it is not an indictment of the Saad Hariri government. It is an indictment of the overall governance of the system, going from the presidency of the republic to the Chamber of Deputies, parliament, and to government. So it's not a matter of just of Saad Hariri. Remember that nearly all governments that we've had in the past 15, 20 years have always been coalition governments, bringing together parties across the spectrum. And therefore, it is not an issue of one particular party. It is against the system, and this is what you're seeing. Whereas if you look at Hong Kong, it was much more directed at government and some decisions by government. Here, there's a questioning of the overall system.
I'm sure many of the issues that you've outlined, some of the challenges they're facing, were issues 20 years ago when you were running the economy ministry.
That's correct.
And 15 years ago when you were very senior in the central bank. If you were back in those positions now, what would be your 5, 8, 10-point plan?
Well, what you need is deep structural reform. That means that you need to address macro issues, fiscal issues, financial issues. The biggest problem that you have immediately is the large level of debt. Debt to GDP is running around 155%, with an average rate, interest rate of around 7%. That's about more than 10% going in interest. So what you need to do is to lower the level of debt. You can do that through privatization. That'll be one of the things that you could do. But you need to improve the governance of the state-owned enterprises that you want to privatize. But most likely, if you want to go ahead, you're going to have to do something about the level of debt by reprofiling it or potentially thinking of a haircut on the debt, maybe not as deep as what you've had in other countries. Then you've got to do something about the size of government. We have a large number of government employees. There's some over 300,000. That's one of the highest compared to a population of about 4.2 million. That's one of the highest burdens in the world with a very low level of taxation. So you need to do something about the size of government itself in terms of ministries, agencies, various councils.
They have abolished the information ministry, I think, if they're not.
Yes, but that's not going to do much. I'm all for greater freedom of information, but it's not going to do much to lower the fiscal deficit. So you need to revise the pension system. That's another area. You need to combat corruption. And the way to do that is to have a modern procurement law that has to be put in place. You need more competition. So it is reforms across the board. But above all, I think it is issues like the pension system, where it is now unsustainable and you can no longer continue.
Dr. Saidi is the president of NASA Saidi and Associates and a former economy minister in Lebanon. Appreciate your time. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning live on air from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.